Welcome to the Global Development Institute podcast. Based at the University of Manchester, we're Europe's largest research and teaching institute addressing poverty and inequality. Each episode, we'll bring you the latest thinking, insights, and debate in development studies.
Today, I am delighted to be speaking to Professor Beena Agarwal, Professor of Development Economics and Environment at the Global Development Institute at the University of Manchester. Beena, thank you very much for joining me today. We'll be discussing your research over the last 5 or 10 years, looking at sustainable livelihoods through group farming in places such as India and Nepal. But before we jump into the research, as ever, I'm keen to understand your journey that took you to this very successful point in your life. You studied at or worked at some of the most esteemed universities in the world, Cambridge, Princeton, Harvard, New York, now Manchester. Picked up many awards along the way, including the Padma Shri, which I understand is India's equivalent of an OBE, roughly, and also the 2017 International Balzan Prize. You were the second woman from the Global South to ever receive this, the first being Mother Teresa. Before all of that, I'm interested in any experiences or inspirations early in life that kind of set you on this path towards your passion for global development and social change. Any examples?
Well, you know, the issues of social justice and inequality have always been important to me, and also quite early on, gender inequality. So I had my maternal grandmother still lived in the village while we were living in Delhi. And when I visited her, I remember I was about 4 or 5, and you still had quite a feudal structure in the village. You had caste differences. You also saw that there were gender differences. There were quite a lot of restrictions on where women could go and not go. And as a child, you really observed that. And you also see difference as injustice. So for me, those were the earliest I can remember of feeling that these issues are important. Of course, I was not able to, at that point in time, it was not part of any curriculum. Mm. And my taking up research on these questions only happened around the time of my doctoral dissertation, or even earlier, actually. One of the earliest articles I'd written on women in agriculture was in the 1970s after my undergraduate in Cambridge. Mm. And I decided to return to India. And before I took up a short job for a month and a half, and before I started my PhD, I did some writing. So these questions have been important of looking at inequality and poverty, but also from particular perspectives, such as of gender.
And were you always, I suppose, a good student at school, always keen to learn, always keen to kind of push the boundaries?
Yeah, you know, I did physics, chemistry and math in school, but also I was a vociferous reader. I loved English literature and poetry. So I devoured books, you know, whatever I could lay my hands on, and particularly fiction. So in choosing economics for college was incidental. I didn't study it in high school. I was thinking of either taking physics or English literature. Wow. And then my father, I was not 16 then. We went to college quite early in those years. And my father sat me down and then discussed it. And he said, well, you know, with physics, you might end up just in an underfunded lab. And you can always read literature. So why don't you think of economics, which is scientific, and you could tell a good story.
Yeah.
So I was quite open to it. And I said, okay, let's try it out. And so that's, so I took up economics honors in college.
Yeah, brilliant. Fascinating story. So let's jump into your research then, and your research with Manchester. So today we're focusing on generally on farming in South Asia, specifically to start with the abundance of small scattered farms and these farm plots. Can you set the scene as to what you mean by, you know, a small scattered farm and what these would involve, just so our listeners can kind of picture what we're starting with?
Well, I think if you look at it globally, something like 84% of farms across 111 countries are less than 2 hectares in size. And in India, 86% of farmers cultivate less than 2 hectares. Some 70% cultivate less than 1 hectare. So these are very small farms. Mm-hmm. And so not only do they face diseconomies of scale, but they can't invest viably in machinery. They also have less access to inputs and credit, and they don't have much bargaining power in markets. So I thought about that for quite a while, and I thought that, well, why wouldn't an answer lie in people pooling their resources to more, especially land, and move from a marginal farm to at least a medium-sized farm, which could bring various kinds of benefits, including economies of scale, and so on. I might mention that the notion of group farming, it can take various forms. Farmers coming together to cultivate jointly. Mm-hmm. And you have the infamous examples of forced collectivization in socialist countries,
yeah.
You know, in the USSR and in early years in China and in many Eastern European countries. And we know now that they were disastrous in terms, by and large, in terms of welfare and productivity and so on. So you have those examples, which you wouldn't see as success stories. Mm-hmm. But you also have examples in the 1960s where countries, post-colonial countries were getting their independence from colonial rule across Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Mm-hmm. And they were undertaking land reform. So they decided that let's try also forms of group farming, partly influenced by the socialist experience. So sometimes entire villages were encouraged to do this, like Ujamaa in Tanzania. But also in India, there were experiments where the government encouraged farmers in the village to come together. Now, these didn't succeed because they were very large. They brought in people who had conflicts of interest. Large and small farmers had different conflicts of interest, so they didn't work either. And you have then examples of success stories which emerge in the post-socialist period. The examples that I'm studying now in India and parts of Europe are very different, which is that they are voluntary, they are small in terms of groups by and large, and people can bring their own land or leased in land, and they can leave the group if they want. So there's no forced pressure from outside.
So just so I could kind of picture some of the simple benefits of group farming, is it things like, yes, many farms can all pool their resources to buy a significant piece of equipment that they would then share? Is it that sort of thing?
So if you imagine that, so take a landscape where you have very large numbers of 1 hectare farms or even half a hectare farm. Mm. And then if you imagine that some of them have scattered plots, so they have even that 1 hectare may be divided into 3 or 4 plots in different parts of the village.
Yeah.
So you need land consolidation of some sort in order to be able to, just save time and put in labor and, of course, invest in machinery. So the advantages of a group are, firstly, there's the advantage of size itself, that you have certain kinds of economies. Mm-hmm. as you scale up. Then you can save on inputs, you save on labor,
yeah,
labor costs. And as you said, you can also purchase machinery together. And don't forget, different people have different skills and different knowledge systems.
Mm.
So you pull together skills and knowledge systems as well. And, in parts of India, you still have feudal relations. You have large landlords and very small tenants. So as a small tenant, you often have to give unpaid labor to the household of the landlord. Mm. So you don't have very much bargaining power. But if you're working as a group, you could scale down the rent, and you could say, no, we are not going to give this unpaid labor. So there are many many advantages, potential advantages. And then if you're women farmers, you know, the increasingly, again, you find globally in most parts of the world, except Europe, you find that as men move out of agriculture much faster than women do, you have large numbers of women left behind who are effectively managing the farm but without owning the land. Mm. And as individuals and, you know, on their own, de facto female headed, it's much more difficult for them in all these respects. And then if you can think of social norms that, you know, you have difficulties of mobility, if you're on your own, you know, you want to go to the town to buy some inputs, and traveling alone isn't always an option. So these advantages get multiplied if you're talking about women farmers.
Okay. And these group farms can be several hundred small farms all grouped together. They can be quite sizable.
No. Well, at least in South Asia, that is not the case. And okay. If you have very large numbers, it's not also very effective.
How many, because you have collective farms would group then?
You can think of size in two ways. One is how many people come together, how many farmers come together to form a group. And that has to be small usually, because you're going to have problems of coordination.
Yeah.
Now then, depending on, you know, your access to machinery and so on, how much land you then command in the group can be large. Typically, land is very scarce in most countries, in developing countries, and especially in South Asia. Mm-hmm. So you have, you can't lease in large amounts of land. In Europe, it's quite different. I've also been looking at group farming in Europe, in France, in Norway, in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And there's some examples in the UK as well, and Romania. So here you have only a small group of people, but the area is large because they're very mechanized.
Okay, understood. So looking at the kind of timeline now of your research and your work, I suppose it all starts with your 1994 book, A Field of One's Own, very successful book, multi award-winning book, referenced by policymakers in government, UN, researchers around the world. Can you briefly tell us the kind of the key messages of that book, which then led on to some of the work around group farming?
You know, prior to that, I had been working on agriculture and technological change, and found that women farmers had very little access to technology. And that also revealed that they had rather little access to land. So this book covers 5 countries. It's quite ambitious. And it was the first book of its kind which actually asked the question, why do women need independent rights in land, that is independent of their families? Because in economics, there was an assumption that if you're married to, or you live in you're born into a rich household, you're rich. Mm. But you find that there is huge amounts of inequalities within households. So this argued that women need to have, if you like, a field of their own, mm-hmm. which is the title of the book. In that, I both made the case of why it was important, but I also then looked at where are the obstructions and constraints. I looked at inheritance laws and social norms and practices which made a gap between law and practice. Mm-hmm. Now, in the last chapter of that book, then I discuss, because there is rather limited land available in most countries, in developing countries, individual titles may still not give you viable livelihoods.
Yeah.
So I discussed for the first time the possibility that if women came together and either jointly purchased land, mm. or they managed land, or both, then that it could provide viable livelihoods. So the notion, the embryo of this, of the ideas that I'm currently researching, go back a long way.
Mm. So before we move on with looking at group farming a little bit more, you mentioned there inheritance laws, and you were telling me before that you taught yourself the inheritance laws for 5 different countries?
I did. And these are extremely complex, yeah. because they vary by region, by religion, and type of property. Mm. So if you're a Hindu woman in northern India, your rights in land will not only be different from those of Muslim women or Parsi women, but they will be different from other Hindu women in southern India.
Okay.
So I had to look at all the states in India and then Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Sri Lanka. And that was a fascinating journey because I actually went back historically also when laws were not codified to the Dharma Shastras, you know, the and the 11th, 12th century codes, which defined how Baha people would inherit property as well.
Yeah. Incredible. And you said you eventually taught inheritance law.
I was invited to teach law in and do a course in inheritance law at the New York University School of Law to law students.
And
I enjoyed that. Yes.
Yeah, it's impressive. Such a vast self-taught thing to then teach that to others is very impressive. So focusing on group farming then, you've given us a really good introduction to what group farming is, what the benefits can be. Following your book, you know, going through this timeline again, many places took on the kind of suggestions in your book and implemented group farming. Is that correct?
Not entirely, because after A Field of One's Own, I was also simultaneously, I had prior to that worked on environmental governance, especially forests.
Yeah.
So I had a book before 1994 book on forests, and I had suggested community forestry, another form of collective action.
Yeah.
So I out of that came my book, Gender and Green Governance, in 2010.
Yeah.
And subsequent to that, I decided to more systematically research group farming. Although I'd written about this as having potential benefits, the literature I could draw upon empirically was not from India. Most of it was, for instance, from post-socialist countries, Romania, Kyrgyzstan, Nicaragua, East Germany, where literature was emerging. And I was actually looking for ways to do empirical research. And for that, as an economist, you need a sufficiently large sample to draw upon. And it so happened that I was asked to chair the working group on disadvantaged farmers, including women, by the Indian Planning Commission in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2010, I'd written this conceptual paper. In 2011, I then traveled in India, and I found that some of my ideas were operational in Telangana.
Yeah.
And then I discovered that Kerala had a very large scale prior program, which they started in the early 2000s,
mm-hmm.
On group farming. And there was sufficient number of cases in both instances. So I decided to test out more empirically. To answer this question, well, they'll say, okay, you've told us conceptually that these things matter.
Yeah.
These are the advantages, but can you prove it? And so I took on that challenge for myself to a question I had posed to myself. And I collected data to compare group farms and individual family farms in both Telangana and in Kerala.
Yeah.
And it was very complicated and very detailed data to collect, because we collected weekly data for a sample of individual and group farms, weekly data on every input and output, on every crop and every plot for an entire year, 12 to 13 months.
And how many groups was that?
So there were the total sample was about 760 in Telangana, and it was 250 in Kerala.
So about 1,000 groups, and on each group farm, you were looking at the output of every crop.
No, these were not all groups. Okay. They were group and individual farms.
Okay, understood.
And the similar data were collected for both the individual and group farms. Now, the 95% of the individual farms, as it turned out, were male managed.
Yeah, okay.
And the group farms were all women group farms.
Why was that?
Because in both places, they had proactively decided that women were the most disadvantaged, and they would support that.
Right.
The parameters and the principles on which they were formed were not similar, however. So in the case of Kerala, you had groups which were all women. They were small. They were constituted of women who lived in the same neighborhood. They knew each other. And they were somewhat heterogeneous in terms of caste. They were not very poor. I mean, they were poor, but some of them had owned land. Okay. And in the case of Telangana, it was different. They were very large groups because the NGO who implemented this as a project for 5 years, they grafted it onto a pre-existing women's empowerment program. So they had these very large groups for social empowerment in villages, in some 500 villages. Mm-hmm. Some of the groups varied. On average, there were 22 women per group, and some of them went to 50 women. Wow. In the case of Kerala, 6 women was the average.
Yeah.
In Telangana also, they were the groups were all mostly caste disadvantaged.
So
the interesting thing was that in my results, I found that Kerala was hugely successful in comparison to individual family farms.
What was the measure of that success, Bina?
So, for instance, I looked at the annual value of output per hectare. Mm-hmm. And I found that was 1.8 times higher in the group farms compared to the individual family farms. The net returns per farm were 5 times greater. And, you know, I did what economists do. I did regressions. I controlled for all inputs and outputs and demographic variables. And you found that these results were just held very strongly. And in particular crops like bananas, the women were able to negotiate contracts, but individual farmers couldn't because they could deliver on contracts.
Why not? Just because they were too small? Or?
Well, you know, you have constraints. You know, if you're a group, you don't need to import labor. You can use your own labor and so on. So the person, in this case, the temples, they had confidence that the women will be able to deliver.
Okay.
But as if you're dependent entirely on a very small family, Kerala families are quite small, then you would be less confident that they would deliver on the contract. I would imagine that's one of the factors.
Okay, that makes sense.
Now, Telangana didn't do as well. It was not as successful in terms of productivity, although in terms of net returns, it was almost even because it saved on hired labor. So then the question, of course, an important question for me, because I was looking for principles of what would make for success.
Yeah.
So comparing the two was important. And that's where I arrived at these aspects that a small group, which is somewhat heterogeneous, which is open to commercial farming and so on, is more likely to succeed. And they were also connected to each other. So they formed what one can call a spine. So if you have, say 20 groups in a small area, and if they're all connected to each other and they are federated upwards. So what Kerala had done, it was very well designed program. They had connected all these women's group farms vertically to the level of the village council.
Okay.
And so they were called community development societies, and they were registered as autonomous bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't be, they were independent and they could independently negotiate with the village council and with the government. And that negotiating power meant that they wouldn't easily be subject to political interference.
It sounds like quite an innovative approach they took then.
It was very innovative. It was designed there were three main people who designed it, but in interaction with a lot of others. Kerala had a very participative way of planning. It was called People's Plan Campaign. This was in around the late 1990s, early 2000s. So you had the finance minister of the current government was an important person, one of the important leaders in this. He was then, earlier he was a professor I am. Of economics.
Yeah.
And so he had written a lot on decentralization.
So now they're moving from group farming to groups of group farming. Is that, am I understanding?
Well,
that right?
No, groups will, you know, the groups are small, but then when you can be at different levels. So suppose you want to market together, you cultivate in small groups, but then you can bring your produce together to market jointly, or you can have, you can even set up machine stations. So individual groups may find it difficult, even though as five or six women, they would find it difficult to get enough finances, even if they get credit. But if there are many of them, then you could set up, say, a machine station or something else. In both states, the government did provide support.
Okay.
But in Telangana, it was only for 5 years.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. So in Kerala, it was a huge success, but there were still some changes or still some improvements that you helped them with?
Yeah, I shared my results with the with Kudum Shri, which is the mission, which was responsible for the poverty eradication program in all of Kerala. Mm-hmm. And they were very open because this was the first very detailed, empirically rigorous study, which firstly showed them that, yes, there is success.
No real evidence before that then?
There were case studies, but, you know, there wasn't a systematically collected, randomly stratified sample with such detailed data.
Yeah.
And there was, when I started the research, there was nothing to indicate that I would find these results.
Really?
It could have very well gone the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, women in general have faced much more disadvantage. You know, many of these women had never managed farms. They had worked as farmers and family farms. So there were disadvantages that they started out with. So these results were helpful to them as an indicator, yes, this works in terms of productivity as well. Mm-hmm. But also my results showed that they could be much more inclusive of caste disadvantaged women.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to, so they did a correction on that. They wrote to me saying that they found it useful and they would now bring in more Dalit women into the groups proactively or encourage them. And the women themselves, there were a big flood in 2018 in Kerala. So some of these results could be used to support the applications for bank loans and so on to show that they were very productive. And this was informal feedback that I received as well from Kerala.
So all these kind of this research you did, I suppose, informed the right way to do group farming and the kind of successful way of doing that. And that's now been implemented in many, many areas. Do you have any idea of numbers or is it difficult?
They've been... In Gujarat, for instance, which is in Western India, I did a workshop and they started group farming using these principles.
Mm.
And similarly, in Eastern India, I didn't hear about this until later, but they wrote to me saying Eastern India and Nepal. So this is a much more feudal context where you have large landlords. And they then began group farming. And I've done research on that. And that's, again, quite successful.
Yeah.
In terms of numbers, they are small, but they now want to scale up. And it's only when the state government is willing to invest, as Kerala did, for instance, that I think you can scale it up to that level.
And is it? I mean, we're looking at impact here. Is it possible to kind of pick a number of how many people maybe impacted by your research, or is that just too difficult to even estimate, do you think?
Several hundred, I would say, if you take the Eastern India, Nepal, and the Gujarat, Western India case. In the case of Kerala, it's difficult to say, you know, because it was only an addition to what they were already doing.
Yeah.
But I think it has huge potential. So the more people hear about it as a possibility, and if one can then convince policymakers that this is a good way to go, then it could be scaled up much faster.
Yeah.
I might mention that among policymakers, the 1960s experiments which didn't succeed.
Mm.
Is often mentioned that, you know, it didn't work earlier, so it won't work. So you have to then tell them that, look, the principles were just not adequate. They were you have to build them on very different and on a very different model, and that model can be successful.
Yeah.
So, for instance, India has 6.6 million self-help groups, which are small groups which do savings and credit, and they could become the basis for group enterprises. During COVID, for instance, the large numbers, thousands of these self-help groups then created masks, they sanitizers, PPE kits, and they worked together. It wasn't like each individual woman working on her own, piece of livelihood. And so this is the model which is successful in terms of other things. Mm. And this is what can be built on.
You mentioned COVID as well. COVID proved, I suppose, as another test that these group farms are more viable, more kind of, they can stand up to the challenges such as COVID or such as flu.
Very much so. So for instance, in Kerala, it's their own figures. They've some 31,000 group farms were cultivating in March of 2020. And 87% of them survived economically. They were able to sell their produce. They had enough labor among themselves to harvest their crops. Whereas a lot of the individual farmers, both in Kerala and elsewhere, were not able to survive because of shortages of labor, harvest labor, and because of shortages of transport and the ability to sell their produce. Then again, I also inquired from the Gujarat groups and the Eastern India groups. And they again said that if we were much more food secure as a group than we would have been if we had only remained as individual farmers.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. And obviously we're very much focused on the UN Sustainable Development Goals. For me, this research seems to tick loads of them. You know, poverty, safe work, food. Is the one that stands out to you as the kind of the key SDG that this research addresses?
I think three of them, poverty, food security, and gender equality. Mm-hmm. It all three of them. I must emphasize that this model doesn't have to be an all women model. Yeah. Yeah. So in Eastern India, there are also all male groups and mixed groups. Mm. And they are found to be. I'm very glad to see that it's been adapted in different ways, much more organically by local communities. But I would say at the very least those three, because even in the mixed groups in Eastern India, the women have learned new skills. They handle machinery. Mm. They go to markets. So there's always a gender component even in the mixed groups.
So it really is a model to empower women then in these countries.
Women and small farmers and marginal farmers in general. Hmm. Even when I was doing my research in Kerala, I found that all male groups were emerging because they found that the women's groups were successful.
Yeah, I bet.
You see? Hmm. So certainly poverty and food security it would take. Yeah. And then, of course, the gender equality question comes in as well.
Yeah.
SDG 5 as well. Within SDG 5, you also have it. It brings it full circle in a way because one of the targets in SDG 5 is women's rights in land and property. Mm. So it brings it full circle to a field of one's own.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I first started talking about it. And that book, because it was embraced by civil society, by policymakers, and the United Nations, and globally, the messages of it were then carried by multiple people upwards. I mean, I didn't have to do workshops. I did do workshops, and that helped. But there were the messages become so generic now that it's going to stay. It's not going to go away.
Yeah, and how is that message going to keep being spread then? Is it really key to get the policymakers on board with it and then the policies can trickle down?
Well, you see, when A Field of One's Own came out in 1994 and, I had a book release and so on, it sort of clicked, every newspaper within a month had carried reviews of it.
Really?
There were interviews on television Very soon after, the Chief Minister of Madhya Pradesh, one of the states, Central India, he had framed a new policy on women in 1995. Mm. And there were large parts of, you know, there's a whole section on it, on women's land rights, which had never existed before.
Wow.
So they picked that up. The women's movement and civil society said to me, "You've written a book for us." There were left-wing groups who said, "This is a new way to approach land reform."
Yeah.
You know, we kind of come to a dead end almost, and now this is a new way to approach land reform. So then the book began to win a number of prizes. So it stayed in people's attention and in the media attention for a long time. And then we took, I organized some panels in the Beijing conference as well, and encouraged a colleague of mine working on land in Latin America. I said, "Why don't you do something for Latin America?" So she did.
Mm.
She wrote a book. She and a colleague wrote a book on Latin America. It was a different kind of book. But what I'm saying is that it was something that people felt, aha, it's such a simple idea. Why hadn't we thought about it? This is what people told me.
They always are, aren't they? The best ideas always.
Yeah, and obvious. And it was just a shift away from the idea that it's not enough that you are born into a household which owns land, because you're still very, very vulnerable if you don't have a field of your own.
Yeah.
So I think that it just went on and on. You know, as I said, it sort of flew on its own. I do write for the media as well, so I wrote a pamphlet. Which could be used by grassroots groups for their training. It was translated into several languages, Indian languages and so on, and it's still around. It's called Are We Not Peasants Too?
I mean, I could speak to you for hours, I think, Bina, about this, because there's so much work you've done. It's so fascinating. My last question is, what's next for you in this area, but also generally in your research?
Well, this area, I'm going to now pull together many of these case studies. I've also done research on France, on Romania, and I've looked at the work on Norway, and I might do some follow-up work on Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And these are models with variations on the theme. And so I want to do two things. One is to see how one might refine these principles from a context where land is very scarce, where in Europe it's not land but labor which is much more scarce, and can we talk about contextualizing the models and the principles, and then bring in the case studies. So with the book, I hope it'll expand the ways in which people think about things. Often people don't always read journal articles, but when it's an entire book, it gives you much more space to reflect and think.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you might remember, you know, there's a vast amount of work on collective action around the commons. As you know, Ellen Ostrom's work on governing the commons. She was a Nobel laureate, a woman Nobel laureate in economics. And I've done work on governing the commons, on forests as well. But the question is, the principles here are different, because here you are, it's collective action around private property. So that's collective action around public property, forests, water bodies, parks, and so on.
Yeah.
And so this could be complementary, but it requires theorizing on a similar scale.
Understood.
And I'm hoping that the material I have will provide that.
Will that take you to different parts of the world again, those sort of studies?
No, I've already have my, as I said, I went to, you know, I did this paper on Romania. We went to Romania, we followed up old group farms, done work on France. You can't do field cases everywhere globally, but I think what you can do is see if the context is similar, and then you can extrapolate.
Well, Bina, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a fascinating conversation for me. I found it really interesting. Your work is incredibly impactful, and I just want to say congratulations for that body of work and your books and awards. It's very well deserved. But yeah, all the best with your future research, and thanks again for speaking with me.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you.